on behalf of the Poetry Center of the college. The program sponsored by the Poetry Center has recently become a part of the regular instructional program of the college. As an experiment in keeping with the instructional aims of the college and in the hope of attracting students who might otherwise remain unaware of poetry as a living fact, students have been invited to hear Mr. Eberhardt this morning without charge. It's certainly with very great pride and pleasure that the Poetry Center presents Mr. Eberhardt. He has long been recognized as an authentic American voice. Presently, he is consultant in poetry at the Library of Congress. I understand he will hold that job another year. And as such, he says this isn't so, but as such, he is, I think, our unofficial poet laureate. He has been the recipient of numerous awards for the excellence of his work and was recently appointed by the president to the Advisory Committee on the Arts for the National Cultural Center in Washington. His collected poems will appear this summer, and recently he was made a member of the National Institute of Arts and Letters. I think that the outstanding quality of Mr. Eberhardt's work is an admirable and unfashionable integrity, an unusual combination of moral fervor and moral awareness. It seems to me that fervor is easy to maintain if you don't see the difficulties it creates. On the other hand, a full awareness of the difficulties sometimes kills the fervor. Mr. Eberhardt, I think, wonderfully combines youthful vigor and the knowledge of maturity. I'm very proud to present Mr. Richard Eberhardt.
Well, Mr. Lilienthal, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be back here. I was here once before, 4 years ago, I think it was, and I was counting the years up on my fingers, and if it was 4 years that I was here the last time, you see, anything I read this time will be all right because you are entirely a new generation. So I have a fresh start with you and you have with me. It was so beautiful on the campus a few minutes ago that I thought maybe it was getting almost too late in the season for poetry, but I'm glad that we're all in here now and we can concentrate on this for a while. I want to read a little verse play to start on as a memorial to an event that occurred just 10 years ago. Just 10 years ago in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I was then living, several of us decided that we would start a poet's theater. Lyon Phelps is one of the names, and a fine woman poet, V.R. Lang, who subsequently, unfortunately, died in her 20s, and Molly Howe, who had, as Molly Manning, had played in Ireland in Yeats's Abbey Theater, and other poets whose names you would know, like Wilbur and Charty, came into it a little later. We decided to see if we could write plays. We spent that summer trying to write plays, and I want to read you the first one that I wrote. It is short, and you'll be hearing it in just a minute. But let me say that the reason we wanted to write drama was that even then, all these professional poets saw that there was something more to poetry than the lyric. America is great in the short lyric, and many poets have found that the natural expression of exuberance. We are a nervous people, and we can give out in short space. But could one really construct a plot and build characters reacting against each other? That was the question. Well, this is not a lecture. I want to get on to the reading and get right to the poetry. But I would say that our theater is now going strong in Boston. It's a cultural phenomenon there and a recognized institution. It had no money to start on, but through the years, older poets such as Dame Edith Sitwell and Dylan Thomas have read for us and given the proceeds to the theater. I.A. Richards was intrigued to write his first verse play the great father of modern criticism himself. He wrote a play called A Leak in the Universe because of seeing our amateur plays. He has turned into a poet now in his mid-60s, as you probably know. Dylan Thomas was sort of stimulated to put the finishing touches on Milkwood, his verse play, and just in his last trip over here, we introduced him in our theater and gave his play its first production. However, it was much changed only two weeks later when it was given at the YMHA in New York. One cannot boast of our successes. Mr. McLeish wrote The Trojan Horse, and this music crept by me upon the waters for our theater, or if he didn't write it for it, these plays were given there first. But then he went on, as you know, to a Broadway success with J.B. If you should go to Boston or spend any time there, I hope you will go and see some of the productions of the Poets' Theater. Well, this little play came out in Poetry Magazine in March 1951, and it posits three groups of people, three young married intellectual couples, and they are making more or less sophisticated talk. By the way, can everyone hear me in the hall? If you cannot hear at the rear, would you raise your hands so I can see how we're doing? Fine. There is a framework around this little, the real action. The framework is the sophisticated talk at the start. Then it moves into the main action of the little play, and then finally the frame is closed or another frame is put around at the end. It's called the apparition. Characters: Robin Everyman, Burl Everyman, Jason Curley, Wendy Curley, Charlie Westgate, Grace Westgate, young girl. Scene: the living room of the Everymans with a small room beyond. Robin and Burl are alone. Robin: I thought our last group play came off pretty well. Burl: I did too. What will we do tonight? A knock at the door. Enter Jason and Wendy, Charlie and Grace. Robin: hello, come in. Burl: hi, nice to see you. Sounds of hello, hello. Jason: scholarship is so exhausting. I am tired of footnotes. What are we going to have tonight? Wendy: I would like it light. Grace: and something spicy. Charlie: we all want frothy fun. Robin: Burl, get some drinks. She goes to get drinks. They take seats in the living room, making small talk. Burl returns, serves beer in mugs. Robin: tonight we have a quickie. Our last was heavy. A little picture of an impish situation. Shall we get on? Cries of assent. Your eagerness is disarming. We need a bed in this one. Charlie, Jason, lend a hand. Charlie: why, sure. Jason: okay, that's easy. They move a divan onto the inner stage at the end of the room, then reseat themselves. Robin: all else we need is a lissome apparition. I will be the everyman, the protagonist, myself. The scene is a hotel bedroom in a large Midwestern city. It is midnight. John, we will call him, is sitting up in bed writing. I'll put on no disguise. Think me now, John. He goes to the bed, first making an exit to reappear in night clothes. He is sitting up in bed in pajamas and dressing gown. John: I guess I will write my wife before retiring. He begins to write, writes a page, speaks. My dear sweet Chuck, I have done 400 miles, am now propped up in bed, nerves reiterating the candor of the day-end unstable roadbed. Midnight is growing slowly to be helpful. I'll soon see you. I am restive to be with you. There are three short knocks on the door. Robin stumbles out of bed, goes to the door in his pajamas and dressing gown, a natural gesture of one expecting nothing or something perfunctory. A young girl abruptly insinuates herself into the partially open door, enters. Robin: well? Girl: well, here I am. May I come in? John: you are in, it seems, or am I having a nightmare? She is young, thin, rather high-strung, but pliable and eager in manner. Girl: I am having such a bad time. May I sit down? John: why, I suppose so. Have that chair over there. This is quite extraordinary. You're pretty. Girl: that is what they all say. Actually, I am not. At least nobody thinks so at the post office. John, what do you do at the post office? Play post office? Girl, I don't know what you mean. I work there, of course. They have a lot of extra girls during the war. John, going back to bed, somewhat embarrassedly, sitting up in bed. How old are you? Girl, going on 20. What do you think? John, I thought I had done all my thinking for the day. What can I do for you? Do you want a drink? Girl, I never drink much. My mother says it is a bad thing. John goes to bathroom, pours out 2 whiskeys and water. John, here, take this. It will cheer you. You seem unhappy. Do you live here? Girl, of course I live here, have all my life. John, does your family live here too? Girl, my mother is left, an older sister who is married and has kids. They drink. John, I am just passing through. I have driven all day. Girl, why don't you stay for a while? It's a good town. John, well, that is very nice of you. I have other things to do. Girl, you seem to be a nice sort. Mind if I talk? He goes over and takes hold of her and brings her over to the bed, where she half reclines, holding distance. John, we might dispense with talk. You have soft skin. Have you ever done anything like this before? Girl, say, what do you take me for? She repulses a minor advance. I'm feeling fine. John, don't you think this is a dangerous thing to do? Girl, what if I scream? They'd have you in a minute. John, I had thought of that, of course, some time ago. You interest me. You seem troubled. What is it? Girl, it's my ancestors. They are trying to destroy me. Sometimes they come through my window in the night. John, you look Irish. Girl, that's it. I guess they all were. I've never had any happiness at all. John, you seem somewhat fiery, rebellious, proud. Come here, let me soothe you a little. It's quiet. He pulls her to him. She rises defiantly, goes to other side of the room, sits in a chair. Girl, you are all alike. I've just been reading Robinson Jeffers. You're vile. You are vile, all of you, vile. John, do you read much poetry? Girl, he's the only one I ever read. John, how did that happen then? Girl, never mind. I like him. I read all night sometimes. John, what did you come in here for? Didn't you think it would be dangerous? Girl, who cares for danger? Do you think I am a fool? I'm bored. I've been bored since 8 o'clock. I was at a party downstairs in the dining room. My boyfriend bores me to death. I can't escape him. He's always taking me out to dinners and dancing. John, would you like a little more to drink? Girl, well, maybe. He pours 2 more drinks, goes back, gets back into bed. John, take it easy now, take it easy. Girl, I just couldn't stand it another minute. I said to myself, I'm going to take the elevator and go to the 13th floor. Then I'll get out, turn to the right, walk down 3 rooms, knock on the door 3 times, and see what happens. John, I must say you are rather adventurous. What if it had been an old lady, deaf in one ear? Girl, I'd leave, mumbling that I had made a mistake. John, what if it had been a man younger than I am, a wild one? Girl, I don't know. I like talking with you, though. John, I confess I am not given to this sort of thing. Girl, say, you talk funny. What are you, anyway? John, I'm traveling and took this hotel room for the night. You seem much quieter now. Your nerves are eased. The drink has done you good. I'm glad you came, as I was feeling nervous. I now feel fine. But wouldn't you like to make a little love, maybe just a little? Girl, you are all alike. I hate love. It makes me sick in the stomach. John, do you know anything about it? Girl, my mother told me. I have to be careful because of confession. John, oh, so you're a Catholic. That makes a difference. Girl, oh, what shall I do? I am very much upset, and I must decide by Saturday. It is unnerving. John, good heavens, what must you decide by then, by Saturday? Girl, whether to become a nun. John, no wonder you are perturbed. Now, whatever do you want to become a nun for? You are young, and I think you quite attractive. Girl, the world is so cruel. My mother wants me to. To take the veil is so pure and clean, a dream I've had as I grew up. It is sweet and pure. The world is so vile. It's all so vile, so vile. John, do you understand what you are renouncing? Girl, I understand the glory I would find. John, it is a hard choice. I wish I could help you. If that is what is troubling you, my dear, it seems an odd thing that you are here. Girl, I can put them off for a month from Saturday. I've never been south. I want to go to West Palm Beach. I'm going there. I must, and lie in the sunshine. And then I'm going to decide once for all. So I approve of your going south. A great deal of sun would help you. I should think it might help a lot. Girl, you are nice, but I must go. It must be getting late. John, don't hurry away. Girl, say, if you ever come again, I'd like to have you out to the house. Here is my address. We could sit on the porch swing. John, that is rather a sweet thought. Thank you so much. Maybe our paths will cross another time. Girl, goodbye, good night. John, good night, goodbye. She leaves. They all get burned sooner or later, son or man. Then he pauses and then says, take care of this thy servant, O son of man. Takes up his letter again in bed, writes, then reads, long drives alone were not for such as your lover, haunted by midnight dreams of beauty. It is the witching hour of night. I'll see you soon. Curtain. Then they begin talking at once. Jason, a quickie, bogged in the love of Pete. Grace, no play if she had been 5 years older. Charlie, she would be played on in another way. Robin, the play's the sting. Burl, a very light playbill. Charlie, the audience would want more billing and wooing. Robin, I tell you, this is pure imagination and that it is absolute reality. Jason, he's Irished it, bogged down for the love of Pete. It is really the blue flower of Novalis. Charlie, a touch of every man. Jason, a very man. Robin, Jones, very? Charlie, very good, a very light. Jason, a touch of every man makes all men sin. It is the thinnest theater we are in. Haven't you a poem, Charlie, about women, the one that came out in the specific director? Let us have meat to this sauce and season. Robin, women are a meaty matter. Wendy, does he reason well? Robin, I recall his women as digestible. Charlie, I have a poem called An Emblem of Viable Women. Jason, pentametric, hexametric? Grace, if he is telling the truth, I got him just in time. He never could keep a woman off his line. Charlie, if you will all quiet down a little, I'll read it. Burl, we are souls of decorum. We are pure tact. Charlie, showing a fit of artistic temperament. No, I'm not in good voice. I'm nervous, nerves dancing. Wendy, on that sober note, we had better go home. They all make gestures of leave-taking. Jason, my fleeces need attending to. Charlie, I'm hydroptic. Grace, let's go home. Soon you'll be barbituritic. I'll fix you. Robin, you are a lithe devil. I think you are positively angelical. Robin, a dualist of the schizophrenic unity. Burl, his dual is to keep himself being dual. Robin, dualism henceforth always be my rule. Charlie, and tool. Wendy, and fuel. Jason, and stool. Robin, my fool, my jewel. They seem to weave back into the room in a kind of rhythmic dance, as if their enthusiasm their enthusiasm for the evening's performance needed a unified ritual, which they grow into quickly and formally. They surround Robin in formal attitudes, making a half circle about him as they develop and perfect the following routine. Grace, you're a scream. Wendy, you're a dream. Robin, I'm a filibuster. Jason, you're a huckster. Charlie, a bit of a mucker. Robin, hugger mugger. Jason, you're a parliamentarian. Charlie, you're an elementarian. Grace, you're a platypusarian. Robin, I'm elemusinarian. Grace, boo. Wendy, who? Burl, you? Robin, true. Let's keep it light and gay and whisk dull capers away. Jason, and titivate tractarians. Wendy, and diagnose Sumerians. Charlie, accept rights riparian. Grace, occlude notes totalitarian. Burl, engender fanfaroles and catch at catches. Robin, chortle at midnight, raise all the latches. Wendy, and sing. Burl, and wing. Jason, and ping. Charlie, a ring around capable treasure. Burl, surfeitless pleasure. Robin, a true dance measure. Grace, nonsense. Jason, is nonsense. Charlie, pretense. Robin, common sense investigator. Jason, imitator. Wendy, hexter. Burl, prevaricator. Robin, theatrical. Wendy, syntactical. Charlie, magical. Burl, a madrigal. Robin, fantastic. Wendy, grammatic, pragmatic. Charlie, astigmatic. Robin, spasmodical. Wendy, rhapsodical. Charlie, angelical. Burl, coromandelical. Jason, sal hepatica. Wendy, bovrility. Charlie, nux vomica. Robin, Coca-Cola. Burl, poet. Jason, painter. Grace, musician. Robin, priest. We're all going up in a cloud of yeast, a land of yeast and fevers of the beast. They all calm down, finally standing still. Another time we'll stalk another stance and search out man in his deceiving dance. And if you'll be our loves and come with me, since we feel tragical, we'll try another comedy. Well, that was just for a starter. One is always trying to figure out what poetry is, and it's very difficult. The other day, just on this trip, I've been down in the Arizona and part south, coming out to you here. I wrote a few sentences, which I'll see if I can read in my handwriting. These are sort of definitions about poetry. Poetry is the best foot forward. Poetry is grief raised to joy in spite of unanswerable enigmas. The excessive claims of poetry are like virtue. Poets rebuke machinery. They make air engines out of aspirations. They beat the light. Poetry is miles away, but here. Poetry is always presenting a newborn babe to the world. Poetry exists between love and religion as man exists between earth and heaven. When poetry makes you weep, it must be good. Poetry is the improbable made improbably probable. Poetry is grains of chance. Poetry is the stealth of reality stealthily engaged. Poetry brings no money to the psychiatrist. I hope that last is true. Well, now what I would like to do, since we have so short a time together, I would like to take you through a little tour of three decades of my writing, going back quite far and reading just a few poems through these decades to give you a sort of bird's eye view of what I've been up to all this time. So, first, I will take you back to 1928, and I am a young fellow, 22 years old or so, just out of Dartmouth. I've worked my way around the world on a tramp freighter, and I've entered Cambridge University. And in beautiful Cambridge, England, I have taken a walking trip out in the countryside and was startled to see a dead lamb in the daisies. For a lamb. I saw on the slant hill a putrid lamb propped with daisies. The sleep looked deep. The face nudged in the green pillow, but the guts were out for crows to eat. Where's the lamb whose tender plaint said all for the mute breezes? Say he's in the wind somewhere. Say there's a lamb in the daisies. So you can take that either on a literal pictorial level, or you can see it as a transcendental poem. In this little eight-line poem, you'll find some of the ideas that were developed much more in a complex fashion in The Groundhog. Then I will take you right up to the middle of the 1930s. Most of you weren't around, I guess, then. Let's see, 35, 45, 55. Yes, many of you students weren't even in the world. I can't believe it. I was there. and that was a mighty hard time in this country. You probably heard your parents tell about it. The 30s were a terrible decade, and they took the tuck out of a lot of us, and only to be capped by the Second World War. I'm sure this poem wouldn't have been written if it hadn't been for the Depression, because it threw me into introspection And out of this introspection came a Platonic poem harking back to the vision of the world as pure and perfect when we see it for the first time or when we see it in youth. It's called If I Could Only Live at the Pitch That Is Near Madness, and you've probably read it in your anthologies. It's a Platonic poem because it holds that there this sort of vast world soul like a cloud in the heavens, and when we're born, part of the world soul is attached to our bodies, and we go in a mysterious affinity through our years, however many or few. And when we die, the soul goes back and joins the world soul. That is a sort of a pre-Christian idea, as you can see. This poem also owes something, though not literally, to Wordsworth's ode on the intimations of immortality recollected from early childhood, in which, amongst all the wonderful things he said, you'll remember that he said, the child is the father to the man. The idea that we really, from our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting and so on, we come trailing clouds of glory, and that we really start to descend the minute we are born. Well, the 30s were a rough time on millions of Americans, and I can't make any direct connection, but I do think this poem was written probably about 1937 or 8, towards the end of it, and it harks back to the perfect vision of childhood or youth or your time, student time, but not much later than that, because then sooner or later you have to start struggling with moral problems. Maybe you have to start struggling with the problems of the people in this little play, even though that just seems like a comical thing. But sooner or later you have to struggle with the morality of the universe, and you have to, as a mature person, make profound life decisions all the time. And this poem says something about that in the last four lines. If I could only live at the pitch that is near madness, when everything is as it was in my childhood, violent, vivid, and of infinite possibility, that the sun and the moon broke over my head. Then I cast time out of the trees and fields. Then I stood immaculate in the ego. Then I eyed the world with all delight. Reality was the perfection of my sight. And time has big handles on the hands, fields and trees a way of being themselves. I saw battalions of the race of mankind standing stolid, demanding a moral answer. I gave the moral answer, and I died, and into a realm of complexity came, where nothing is possible but necessity, and the truth wailing there like a red babe. Then let us go to 1941, just before the war, when man was still free, and as a matter of fact, I was still very free because I wasn't even quite married yet. So I was a freelance schoolmaster and had been given a house near Exeter, New Hampshire, for a week in the winter. There were 4 or 5 feet of snow on the ground, and I was living alone, studying and reading, meditating in this old farmhouse. It was warmed by a kitchen stove, and that was all. And one time I went out to the kitchen stove, and I saw 2 wasps fall from the eaves and light on the stove. And, of course, they were gelid and cold and stiff when they lit on it, but then they warmed up a little and started going in towards the middle. And as they got in towards the middle, they got quite lively. So in the first time, in all innocence, I brushed them out to the side of the stove, whereupon they could see them congealing and becoming harmless. Then, you see, I was raised I was sort of weaned on Schopenhauer and Nietzsche and on Hardy, people like that. So you can see that my innocence didn't last very long. I immediately began manipulating these creatures as if I were God. And I would push them into the middle of the stove, and they'd get very hot. And when their wings would start flapping, I saw that they might sting me, and then I would just carefully move them out, and I played with them, you see. So, and I didn't think I'd get a poem out of it, but I'm going to read it to you. The poem came later sometime. In the poem, instead of using my hand, I say I use my breath. And there's only one painting allusion in the poem, and that's about God, like God touching his finger to Adam, I felt. And you'll remember the Michelangelo's Sistine ceiling painting with God touching his finger to Adam. New Hampshire, February. Nature had made them hide in crevices. Two wasps, so cold they looked like bark. Why, I do not know, but I took them and I put them in a metal pan, both day and dark. Like God touching his finger to Adam, I felt and thought of Michelangelo. For whenever I breathed on them, the slightest breath, they leaped and preened as if to go. My breath controlled them always quite. More sensitive than electric sparks, they came into life or they withdrew to ice, while I watched, suspending remarks. Then one in a blind career got out and fell to the kitchen floor. I crushed him with my cold ski boot by accident. The other had not the wit to try or die. And so the other is still my pet. The moral of this is plain, but I will shirk it. You will not like it, and God does not live to explain. Then the war came upon us, and everyone said, oh, if you're going into the Navy, you will never write another poem. Every time I've done some new thing, they've always said, oh, this will be the end of you. You can never write another poem. But nothing has stopped me from writing them yet. And the war, instead of killing me off as a poet, gave me several poems that I still read with pleasure. I was an aerial free gunnery training instructor up and down the East Coast and was stationed for about 18 months at Dam Neck, Virginia. And the fact that I wore the uniform of our country meant that I condoned killing. I was raised as a Christian and would like to hope that I am one. I therefore immediately came into an unresolved conflict. How can you kill your brother man if you pretend to believe in the golden rule or in the commandment that says thou shalt not kill? And yet you know that the Christian nations have been the greatest fighters and killers for centuries. And if there's anyone in this room who has the answer to this, I'd be glad to hear it. I've never figured it out myself. My problem was aggravated by the fact that I had a brother-in-law who was a conscientious objector. And he was a very bright Harvard boy, blue-eyed fellow, who decided that he would take Christ literally. He would not kill his fellow man. So he was thrown into camps, work camps in New Hampshire. And after planting dead trees for a year, he decided to go over the hill. So he wrote to President Roosevelt, he wrote to Attorney General Biddle and to Mr. Hershey, told them where he would be. They could pick him up at a certain place in Baltimore. And he forced the government to try him. While the guns were popping and people were going off to battle, my brother-in-law stood alone, a young man, against the whole warring U.S. government, trying to prove that the Selective Service Act was improperly conducted. It said that it should be doing work of national importance under civilian direction. He couldn't see that it was nationally important to plant dead trees month to month, and he proved, or tried to prove, that the military people were running these camps. So after a whole week and four lawyers against him, he mustered up enough family money to get two. The judge rendered his verdict. We have this document. It's very dramatic. Just think, the war was going on at this time. And the judge said that this young man had won his case, that he had proved in the week's testimony that the camps were not doing work of national importance, and that the military men were bossing them. On the other hand, he told the jury that we were at war, and it was their duty under this extreme circumstance to lock him up. So you can meditate on that for morality if you want to. And so they locked him up for 4 years, but he served only 2.5. If I can tell you an anecdote, this will be right in parenthesis before I read the poem. My wife, his sister, sent him a book while he was in prison. And the book was an anthology entitled The Triumph of Life. It had been edited from the Viking Press by Horace Gregory, was just off the press, and his sister thought it might make a prisoner feel good to receive a book called The Triumph of Life while he was making big ones into little ones, as they say. But you were not supposed to send a book through the mails in wartime from your family. The only way you could send a book to somebody was from the publisher. They figured if you sent it from the family, they might insert razor blades, pills, or some nefarious kind of things in the binding. But so the warden called this young man before him, and he said, "How come that you're having this book sent to you by your sister?" He said, "Oh, that's right. This is my, that's her name. That's up there. And this is a book by my brother-in-law. It's a book of poetry." And he said, "Oh, a book of poetry. Well, how come you want a book of poetry?" He says, why, my brother-in-law has a poem in this book, and my sister sent it to me." Oh, very unbelieving, you know, the warden couldn't believe this. And he said, "Oh, so that's what you're talking about." He said, who's your brother-in-law? And he said, "Well, his name is Richard Eberhardt." Whereupon the warden opened the book, looked down the contents. He got A, B, C, D, and he got to E. There was Eberhardt, comma, Richard, and then in parentheses, 1615 to 1680. And what a dramatic and a comical situation. My brother-in-law was practically thrown into solitary confinement for a week. And the warden was all the more confirmed in the notion that this was a very obdurate character. It was, as you guess, a misprint, and if you want to look it up in your library, it never went into a second edition. It's still there. And I was very happy to have been made a late Elizabethan. Well, but through this conflict, this family conflict, I must say I felt so badly one time that when I saw the names of many of the students whom I had taught come back on the death list only a month later, it troubled me no end. And I sat down one time feeling very low, and I wrote this poem, which is called The Fury of Aerial Bombardment. The first three stanzas were written swiftly at once, and they ask questions. In cold rationality, a week later, I added the last four lines in a different mood, in a rational way. There is a good long discussion of this poem in John Chardy's book of last year, How Does a Poem Mean?, from Houghton Mifflin, if you're interested. He finds that every poem has a fulcrum point where there's a balance of, no matter how many lines on one side or fewer on the other, there's a balancing point somewhere in the poem, and he rightly sees the fulcrum in this one is before the last four lines. It's a little poem in only four quatrains, going as follows. Again, you need to know no literary allusions, but you might get an overtone in the phrase, "The infinite spaces are still silent," if you are a philosophy major and have read Pascal, because you remember that at the end of his life, he looked up in the stars and he was frightened by the infinite silence between the stars. The Fury of Aerial Bombardment. You would think the fury of aerial bombardment would rouse God to relent. The infinite spaces are still silent. He looks on shock pride faces. History even does not know what is meant. You would feel that after so many centuries, God would give man to repent. Yet he can kill as Cain could, but with multitudinous will, no farther advanced than in his ancient furies. Was man made stupid to see his own stupidity? Is God by definition indifferent beyond us all? Is the eternal truth man's fighting soul, wherein the beast ravens in its own avidity? Of Van Wettering I speak, and Averill, names on a list whose faces I do not recall, but they are gone to early death, who late in school distinguished the belt-feed lever from the belt-holding Paul. And the last line refers to parts of the machine gun. You don't really have to know more than that. If you want to learn just what these parts are, that would mean a little more. It's the belt feed lever feeds the bullets into the machine gun, and they're shot out of the bore. The holding pole is a ratchet that takes the empty shells off. One critic wrote me just the other day at the Library of Congress, said, did you mean by the belt feed lever that this was life going in and that the belt holding pole was represented death? Well, I hadn't thought of that at all. People read things into your poems that you weren't thinking of, but it's quite all right if he wants to have it that way. I just thought I meant that there was just the lassitude of the idea that they had learned all these parts of the machine gun, and for what? Now we go to the post-war period, and I have become a businessman. And I am out selling goods, and I'm very tired after a hot summer day of work, and I find myself in Newark, New Jersey, of all places, and I took a room in the Military Park Hotel. I thought this was rather incongruous that there should be such a name for a hotel in that city. I wasn't feeling at all militant by this time. I was really quite depleted, and I took a room, and just sort of automatically bought a copy of Life. When I got up to my room in a tired condition, I opened Life to a two-page spread of the most violently beautiful pictures of cancer cells leaping out of test tubes. And this was extraordinary. They were sort of cactus-like things. They were spiky and beautiful in a radical sort of way, and yet instantly you knew that they represented death. So here was this life and death conjoined right before your eyes. Now, I usually write poems by somehow receiving them when they're ready to be born in imagination, months or even years after the experience. But I've written two or three right upon the event. This one I'm going to read you, The Cancer Cells, was written that minute. Just on seeing these pictures, I took out a pencil and had a paper there. I wrote this poem down just the way it is. But most of them are well up into consciousness somehow in a mysterious way later. The cancer cells. Today I saw a picture of the cancer cells, sinister shapes with menacing attitudes. They had outgrown their test tube and advanced, sinister shapes with menacing attitudes, into a world beyond, a virulent laughing gang. They looked like art itself, like the artist's mind, powerful shaker and the taker of new forms. Some are revulsed to see these spiky shapes. It is the world of the future to come to. Nothing could be more vivid than their language, lethal, sparkling, and irregular stars, the murderous design of the universe, the hectic dance of the passionate cancer cells. Oh, just phenomena to the calculating eye, originals of imagination. I flew with them in a piled exuberance of time, my own malignance in their racy, beautiful gestures, quick and lean. And in their riot, too, I saw the stance of the artists make, the fixed form in the massive fluxion. I think Leonardo would have, in his disinterest, enjoyed them precisely with a sharp pencil. Now, when I sent this poem over to England, Shadow and Windows, my publisher, said, well, yes, this is a nice narrative poem. We'll be glad to put that in your next book, but why don't you leave off the last two lines? Well, I really couldn't get this. I thought they were so obtuse and they lost all of their wit, because the last two lines seemed to me to make the poem. And it was the idea that somebody like Leonardo da Vinci, or it's a hopeful idea, really. It's that the artist, or some artist, will make life out of death, will make joy out of sorrow, will make light out of dark. That's the meaning of the last two. So I insisted that they be retained. We go to the coast of Maine every summer, and I've derived quite a few poems from the sea. I'd like to read you one that is called Seals Turns Time. And the idea of this poem is that man is sitting in a rowboat, and he's balanced on the sea, and he sees coming up out of the water the seals, and they come around the boat, and they come up within about 15 feet of you. Well, I don't think I would have got a poem if this is all that had happened, but while I was watching the seals, across the sky came, as if a scarf were pulled swiftly across, a group of fork-tailed terns, the sunlight glistening on their undersides. The beautiful birds swiftly pulled across your vision. Months later, I found the poem, and it came all at once, and I saw that the seals were the symbol of our animal nature, and the birds were the symbol of our spiritual nature, and that man is balanced between them. Now, we think of ourselves as solid and durable, and we are here, but actually, man is seen in the poem as a sort of a creature on a cockle shell, delicately balanced on an integument, and really very flimsy, because what do we only last a few years in the history of the world. Seals turns time. The seals at play off Western Isle, in the loose flowing of the summer tide and burden of our strange estate, resting on the oar and lolling on the sea, I saw their curious images, hypnotic, sympathetic eyes, as the deep elapses of the soul. O ancient blood, O blurred kind forms that rise and peer from elemental water, I loll upon the oar, I think upon the day, drawn by strong, by the animal soft bonds, back to a dim prehistory. While off the point of jagged light, in hundreds, gracefully, the fork-tailed terns draw swift esprits across the sky. Their aspirations dip in mine, the quick order of their changing spirit, more freedom than the eye can see. Resting lightly on the oarlocks, pondering and balanced on the sea, a gauze and spindrift of the world, I am in compulsion hid and thwarted, pulled back in the mammal water, enticed to the release of the sky. And then one that you must have read, The Horse Chestnut Tree. I'd like to tell you the story about this one. This was written just about 10 or 12 years ago, right after the war, when I was living in my father-in-law's house in Cambridge, and there was a great horse chestnut tree in the garden. Every year, as certainly as autumn, troops of wild Irish boys would come down the streets, and they would enter my father-in-law's private garden and assault his tree. And they always wanted to get the nuts that were farthest up, and they attacked the tree with sticks and stones. My dear old father-in-law was getting rather unable to cope with the situation, so I took over as son-in-law. These were really very rough and hardy youths, and as you know, there are a lot of Irish people in Boston. And one time, I rushed out in the garden, and I grabbed one of these fellows by the shoulder, and whereupon he yelled, "Police! Police!" And I must say, I let him go and retreated into the house. So at least I had my revenge by writing the poem. The poem came some months later and was written all at once. Now, Edith Sitwell put this poem in the Atlantic Anthology, where you can read it, and she said she was making up the best poems of the last 800 years. I was terribly flattered to have it in, but then I realized how cranky her judgment may be. So you don't have to like it if you don't want to. But then I must tell you some more maybe about this one. There were some professionals. We used to go to each other's houses in those years and read our newest poems. And these are all people you undoubtedly know and love. I hope there are people like May Sarton and John Holmes used to come, and Richard Wilbur and John Chardy and Robert Lowell. Seven or eight of us every time. Merrill Moore, who has unfortunately died a couple of years ago. And when I read this poem, they said, "Oh, yes, that's a very nice poem, Dick." But they said, "You should have stopped at nine lines before you did, because you get heavy and moralistic towards the end." Now, I'm going to hold up my hand at the ninth line before, and you can make your own judgment. You can be your own critic. I don't think, frankly, I'll give you my answer before I read it. I don't think it would have got into Miss Sitwell's anthology if it had been truncated. The idea of the poem is that these wild Irish boys are really aestheticians. Now, they wouldn't know that word, but they were really Plato's lovers of the good, the beautiful and the true. They were lovers of beauty without loss of manliness. And they represented all these wonderful Greek ideas, because they wanted to hold a beautiful, shining object in their hand, the nut. And it was useless. Isn't that a strange thing, that they really did want to do this? And I remember that I had, when I was a young boy, too. Well, then I saw the analogy that as they fling to the higher branches, it's just like adult man flinging his imagination beyond the skies, the missile age, the space age. We're doing the same thing. And I saw that as they held this nut in their hand, so we, at the end of our lives, have held the round world in our consciousness insofar as we have been able to. Well, the horse chestnut tree. Boys in sporadic but tenacious droves come with sticks as certainly as autumn to assault the great horse chestnut tree. There is a law governs their lawlessness. Desire is in them for a shining amulet, and the best are those that are highest up. They will not pick them easily from the ground. With shrill arms they fling to the higher branches to hurry the work of nature for their pleasure. I have seen them trooping down the street, their pockets stuffed with chestnuts, shucked, unshucked. It is only evening keeps them from their wish. Sometimes I run out in a kind of rage to chase the boys away. I catch an arm, maybe, and laugh to think of being the lawgiver. I was once such a young sprout myself, and fingered in my pocket the prize and trophy. But still I moralize upon the day, and see that we, outlaws on God's property, fling out imagination beyond the skies, wishing a tangible good from the unknown. And likewise death will drive us from the scene, with the great flowering world unbroken yet, which we held in idea a little handful. Well, now I'm afraid the time is moving along much too quickly. Do I have some more minutes or no? No, another couple of minutes. Oh, too bad. You'll have to ask me to come back again. I have. Well, I didn't. But I have lots of more poems. As a matter of fact, look what I brought. I was going to read you all. I've got 50 new poems, which are going to be in the new book, and the collected poems. I hope you'll all have a look at some of those. I would like to read maybe one of these and tell you just about it, if I can find it here. It came out in the New Yorker, and it's about a ship burning and a comet all in one day. And one time up on the coast of Maine, we had put a little boat of 20 feet up on shore, and the man who took care of it said we were lucky to be alive because he could put his fist right through the side. But we put it on the shore on grandmother's lot and filled it with flowers and let the children play in it. But grandmother had an Annapolis 70-year-old brother who argued with the family for the whole year, saying that you should not leave a ship above ground because it was like a person and you wouldn't leave a corpse above ground. It deserved decent burial. And wasn't it a worshipful thing because men always gave ships the name of women? Well, he finally won, and the next summer, on a day in August when the tide was lowest, We had a ceremony that fired me with the greatest imagination and pleasure. It was like being in ancient Greece or like being Beowulf or somebody. We got about 10 men to pull this boat with a rope off down to the very lowest part of the tide, and about 40 people came from around the countryside. Somebody very providentially gave everyone a glass of spirits. And I like to say it was spirits because you can think of it in two ways, but they really all had a nice drink of whiskey. And then I acted as captain and said a prayer over the ship, and I made up the sentence right out of the air, right out of the instantaneously, we consigned her to immortal transubstantiation. Don't you think that's good? And then we all sat on the harsh rocks and watched the tide come in and take the debris away. And when it became dark, a great comet appeared in the sky. And you wouldn't believe it, but it really did. A beautiful comet. And at the end of this long comet was a star right in the nether part of the tail. Well, this was astounding, and it was like a benediction on the whole performance. It was simply tremendous. Well, I wrote this poem, which is a very factual, simple poem, and it came out of the New Yorker, and it will be in the new book. So I would like to read this one to you. A ship burning and a comet all in one day. When the tide was out and the sea was quiet, we hauled the boat to the edge on a fair day in August, as who, all believing, would give decent burial to the life of a used boat, not leave a corpse above ground. And some, setting fires on the old and broken deck, poured on the kerosene with a stately quietude, measuring out departure, and others brought libations in red glasses to the sea's edge, and all held one in hand. Then the captain arose and poured spirit over the prow, and the sparks flew upward, and consigned her with fierce cry and fervent prayer to immortal transubstantiation. And the pure nature of air received her grace and charm. And evening came on the sea as the whole company sat upon the harsh rocks, watching the tide come in and take the last debris. And when it became dark, a great comet appeared in the sky with a star in its nether tail. Well, then if I can have a half a minute, I want to read you one encore, because I just can't resist. I want to communicate this to you, and I want to tell you a story about it. It has a half line at the end, and my British publisher said to leave this half line out. It would have ruined the poem if it left it out. And I'm about a third Irish myself, so I figured they didn't have any Irish wit left to leave this off. Maybe you've read this one. It's called On a Squirrel Crossing the Road in Autumn in New England. It's about almost hitting a little creature in your car, and then pulling to the side of the road and being nerved up. I was nerved up for 3 or 4 minutes and had a sort of a Rambodian illumination, a kind of a, where for a moment I thought I really saw the whole meaning of this little creature in relation to me, a slightly larger creature, and to God. And the whole meaning was seen. And there's this simple little poem, which is the last and is the encore. On a squirrel crossing the road in autumn in New England. It is what he does not know, crossing the road under the elm trees, about the mechanism of my car, about the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, about Mozart, India, Arcturus, that wins my praise. I engage at once in whirling squirrel praise. He obeys the orders of nature without knowing them. It is what he does not know that makes him beautiful. Such a knot of little purposeful nature. I, who can see him as he cannot see himself, repose in the ignorance that is his blessing. It is what man does not know of God composes the visible poem of the world. Just missed him. Thank you.
I want to thank Mr. Eberhardt for a thoroughly exciting reading. He has kindly consented to talk informally with any students and members of the faculty who would enjoy a discussion of poetry today. So this afternoon, he will be available to those who would like to talk with him at 2 o'clock in room 108 of the Science Building. That's 2 o'clock, room 108 of the Science Building. Thank you.